Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Resonant Reels, the podcast where we talk about movies and such. I'm Chandler.
I'm Adam.
And we're back at it. We're talking about some more movies. I think we're just going to hop into it for this one because Adam chose a behemoth of a movie, but then I chose one that's very fun, I feel like, and we have lots to talk about.
Yeah, so I liked Chandler's pick better this week, if I'm being so honest, just in terms of movies. So my pick was The King's Speech.
Oh, we should explain the theme. My bad.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. The theme is, it is July. It is recognized as Disability Awareness Month. So we both picked movies that highlighted disability as a part of the movie. I won't necessarily say the narrative of the movie per se, but like a part of the movie. So I picked The King's Speech from 2010, directed by Tom Hooper. I wish I had picked something different. This is not a first watch for me. And Chandler and I were talking about this a little bit beforehand. I do really like this movie. I think it's a good movie. This was a rewatch for Chandler as well. And we said for both of us, there just reached a point where we were like, dear God, this movie's so long. It's just because it drags. And that's really unfortunate. Like, it gets to, and the reality is it actually isn't that long because it's less than 2 hours by 1 minute. It's an hour and 59 minutes. But it feels like a 3-hour film to me. And that's unfortunate. That made me a little sad because I was excited to rewatch it. I just, the term Chandler used was he started to zonk. And I feel that. I started to get to a point where I was like, help. Like, how much longer do I have to sit through this?
It's part of the pacing of this movie because, like, it feels like there was one huge problem that we were, like, dealing with the main character. And then we, like, kind of dealt with it. But then there was another problem. But we're like, but we just went on such a long journey for this first problem.
Yeah.
And now we have to endure another problem. But then like you're doing it different pacing wise for the second problem because we're already like over an hour through the movie at this point. It was a choice in the pacing.
I guess I'll start with why this movie fits into our theme. For those who don't know, The King's Speech is, you should have watched the movie because that's like the whole part of this, but whatever. The King's Speech is a historical drama film, and it centers on who became king, but at this time in the beginning of the film was like, he was in line technically for the throne, but whatever. It focuses on the later life of King George the sixth. He is played by Colin Firth. Incredible. Amazing job. I can never hate him. He's perfect and lovely. I love him so much. It is historically accurate to say that King George the sixth had a stutter / stammer that he struggled with. He saw a speech and language therapist whose name is Lionel Loge, that is played by Jeffrey Rush. Also amazing job, amazing actor, just incredible. There's some nuances to this. So one of those nuances is that Lionel is Australian, so that's kind of fun. I think part of why I said I am not going to go through the plot of this movie is I just don't feel like getting into all of the British monarch bullshit and like line of lineage and all of that sort of stuff.
I could do a quick briefy thing about it if it helps. Of just like,
do you want to? Absolutely, Chandler. I will let you do that. Go for it.
To start the movie, King George V is in power, but it's like declining health. And we're also at the point where it's like the 1930s at this point. So Hitler has risen to power in Germany. And so there's a lot of fear of that. But then also there's fears of Stalin in Russia at the time with everything. And so there's a big political thing there, is what it is. But it's like way before World War II and for the start of the movie. But King George V is declining in health. I'm going to quickly spoil some of the major plot points of the monarchy in the movie so we just know timeline-wise where we're at. We watch King George V die as he's also like dealing with some form of dementia or Alzheimer's or something near the end of his life and everything. We deal with the politics of Prince Albert, who's our main character, played by Colin Firth, being technically second in line to the throne because his older brother is first in succession. He takes the throne. There's some politics around that because his brother's kind of a party animal, more or less. He's like a, he likes to being this free bachelor kind of guy, but is fairly manipulative by women, it seems like. It's like a weird royal family drama stuff anyways that comes and goes with the royal family a lot in their history. And so essentially with advising from both the Archbishop and then the Prime Minister, Chamberlain at the time, and then also with some nods from Churchill, they have Prince Albert's brother step down from the throne so then he can take the throne. And then he has to deal with immediately the issues of World War II starting up. So that's pretty much like the general politics and historical context of everything, just to kind of get through it.
His brother doesn't even step down. He abdicates. Like, he basically, he's like, I'm not even going to take this. So,
yeah, what's like he wanted it is a messy, it's a messy royal family nonsense. That's like, it's cool to see that part of like what's usually behind closed doors with the royal family, because they're very protective of their history and their image and everything like that. So it's cool to see like that more or less broken out and allowing it to happen. I mean, this movie only got made because George V's wife had to pass before this movie could even go into production or something like that.
Oh,
yeah. It was okay. Like a whole thing.
I picked this particular movie to highlight disability awareness because, one, my mom is a speech language pathologist. That obviously hits close to home. And I very much grew up with being surrounded by people who were differently abled than myself. That ranged from individuals with Down syndrome to autism to just kids who had cochlear implants and or were deaf, blind, just generally like things all across the board. But usually the reason I knew them was because there was some sort of speech issue on top of whatever those other things were. Decided to pick a film where speech was the only disability rather than it being a byproduct of another disability. And that is because stuttering can, but also cannot, it depends, but can qualify as a disability. So this is something that I wanted to make sure of before, you know, I did officially pick it for the movie, because especially now, a person who has any sort of language, you know, or speech issue can receive accommodations for that. And that applies at if you're in a school setting or in a work setting. But in order to receive those services, you have to have some sort of, it's called a fluency disorder diagnosis. I think that's kind of dumb. I don't think you should need an official diagnosis in order to get accommodations for things that you need in your life. And I think that goes for a lot of things, but that is kind of how that works right now. Stuttering and stammering are essentially interchangeable words to describe the same language disability. And then here are just some facts about how somebody might wind up with a stutter or a stammer. One of them is genetics. About 60% of people who stutter have a family member who also stutters. And then the biggest one is childhood development. So just when you are a kid, if you have some sort of developmental delay in your speech and language, then you are more likely to develop some sort of stutter. There is the neurophysiological side of it. When your brain literally processes speech and language differently, there's like a link in your brain that is just different and causes like some disfluency within speech. And then another thing that can contribute is family dynamics. So, and I think that's very interesting to this particular movie, is that if you are in a household where there are very high expectations and there is very fast-paced living, that can contribute to stuttering as well. Three main types just to talk about. There's developmental stuttering, persistent stuttering, and then acquired stuttering. So acquired stuttering is going to be something like you have had a stroke or head trauma or something like that. Developmental stuttering, like I mentioned, is more likely in children, and that kind of is where the neurophysiological thing comes in as well, with that brain link just processing things differently. And then persistent stuttering also starts in childhood but continues on through adulthood. The statistic that I read is that if you have a child who's still stuttering at the age of 7, it's less likely that that stutter is going to be able to disappear completely. And only about 1% of people have persistent stuttering. Yeah, this was all stuff that I kind of grabbed from a majority of different sites. One of the main ones is Ability Central, and just kind of talking about things in my mom's general world of speech and language right now, due to all of the different types of individuals that need speech and language assistance. There is a lot of change that has happened over the last decade and is continuing to happen over terms to use and therapy methods and things like that. So I just want to be very respectful of those changes. And one of the things I absolutely commend my mom on is, like, she is so on top of that. And even in retirement has continued to, like, go to workshops and classes about how language within speech and language is changing for things. And I think that's really cool. So shout out to her for doing that. George, King George VI, is often referred to in this movie by those very close to him as Birdie, because as you may or may not know, when you become king, you have to, you know, have a whole name thing, whatever. So he is technically Prince Albert Birdie, Duke of York. He was, again, never meant to be the one to take over the throne. So some of what we see as well is very much like, it's just how the culture is. Like, his brother was the one who was trained and given this very specific lessons and everything to take over as king, not Birdie. So when David decided that he was going to abdicate and go marry this woman who's on her second divorce, that left Birdie in a wild position of having to take over. As you, again, may or may not know, when you are a monarch, you have to talk to people and you have to give speeches.
Well, what's funny, it's his father, King George V. They have a conversation later in the movie, but it's kings used to get away with just being present, looking stoic, knowing how to ride a horse and not falling off of it. But now, because of these damned radios, we have to know how to speak.
Yes.
We invade people's houses and we have to be the lowest of the creed. Actors, cough, cough.
It's just, it is a good movie. It is a good movie. It just drags for how much is actually, like, within the movie. There's basically what we are working up to within this entire film. As Chandler mentioned, Birdie is taking over kind of as the beginnings of World War II are starting. And so what we are working up to, our big resolution at the end of this movie, is that Birdie, as King George VI, has to broadcast to the entire United Kingdom the declaration of war on Nazi Germany. That is kind of the big, like, oh shit, how do we do this? Because everyone's kind of bugging of, like, if Birdie can't do it without stuttering, then the country will look weak. There is going to be a lack of respect for the monarchy. It's all of those things. And it's really interesting to see how that manifests within different characters, because, like, within those around Birdie, it's kind of like it's a fear for the monarchy and, like, that. But for Birdie, it's very intrinsic. Like, he is worried about it himself. Like, he has a lot of internal shame. He's very self-conscious. And so we're kind of watching him try to battle his inner battles while he's being trained to have to approach the outside battle, if that makes sense. Birdie gives a speech at Wembley Stadium. He is really struggling. This is at the, like, very beginning of the movie, so everybody buckle up. Also, big shout out, Helena Bonham Carter plays his wife, who's also named Elizabeth through this, is getting through this speech as best as possible. But what we're seeing is everybody is just really, really uncomfortable and becomes like very unsettled. That is while he's still the prince. So it's already like not great. And he does not have very high public opinion because of this. And so we find that he has apparently tried multiple speech treatments in the past, and they've all been unsuccessful, and he's ready to just give up. Who I guess is the Duchess, Helena Bonham Carter, is like, why don't you see this Australian speech therapist? He's in London. Persuades him to do that. So in their very first session, something that is immediately kind of taboo that this speech therapist does is he's like, we are going to address each other by our like Christian names, which goes against all royal etiquette. Like that is absolutely not what you do. But therefore, you've got Lionel and you've got Albert. Like those, like that's where we're at. And that is how I will refer to them, slash Birdie. Lionel is just, he's kind of like that weird acting teacher that you walk into class on the first day and he's like, this is what we're going to do. And in the first session, he makes Birdie recite to be or not to be soliloquy from Hamlet while there is classical music blaring in headphones. It's just so weird and like, but it's so clear, like Birdie's getting very frustrated, he's getting very worked up. It's not going well, like clearly. In that process, however, Lionel has made a recording of all that music playing and Birdie like speaking, and winds up giving it to Birdie at the end of the lesson as kind of like a, here you go, our first lesson documented, like here's our day one progress. Basically, that's kind of where we jump in and we start to see their relationship, which I just adore. But yeah, so again, I'm kind of skipping over the political stuff of the film because I just don't feel, I don't know, either watch it, go watch it. It's a less than 2 hour movie. There is a kind of impromptu session with Birdie and Lionel, and Birdie starts to like kind of go off and he's like, even though my like speech has gotten better, I still stutter. He is specifically upset that he still stutters when he's talking to his brother as well, which shows a lot of the kind of like power balance slash power imbalance, I might say, that exists there. That kind of, again, when we're talking about things that could potentially exacerbate a stutter, high pressure situations being rushed, things being very fast paced. And so for Lionel, that was kind of like an ear perk moment, I would say, because Birdie starts talking about like his childhood and like his like dad being, you know, the King George V being very strict. They had a nanny and the nanny favored David and all the, like all of this stuff, just a lifetime of Birdie feeling very inadequate. Lionel kind of speaks up and is like, you could make a very good king. That kind of triggers Birdie a little bit because he's like, what? You can't even say that because what is going on? And basically accuses Lionel of treason and then quits. Like fully just goes off the other side of the deep end there. But they wind up getting back together, Lionel and Birdie, because they have to. Because why? Because David abdicated the throne. Now Birdie is really in a place of, I have no choice but to like make this work. We see Lionel and Birdie's like friendship start to grow, but it's still a very respectful friendship. We can see that Birdie isn't really willing to like dive in because he is now on his way to becoming king. And, you know, there are still all of these like royal etiquette things that have to be followed. And Lionel is like so unusual and so not following any rules, like when it comes to anything. Like it's that statement of like, there's madness in the method. Like that is the epitome of Lionel's character. Another kind of like highlight moment that we get, I will say, is Lionel apparently never told his wife that like he was like fully helping the soon to be king of England, like with his speech, until he like Birdie just shows up. That shit was so funny to watch. That was definitely a good part of the movie, because Birdie just shows up and Lionel's wife is like, what? Like, hello? And as Birdie and Lionel work together, there is some tension from like Birdie's advisors that are kind of like, should the king, the future king, whatever, you know, be seen like with a speech language therapist? Like, is that something that we even want, especially when they were like talking about the coronation day and everything? There was a good part that the Archbishop was talking to Birdie and kind of made a statement about how King George the Fifth had never really like used his advisors when talking about like treatment, and also in the same hand saying that Lionel does not have formal training, and so he's a little bit of a wild card to bring into, you know, this whole area. And that pisses Birdie off, because in his relationship with Lionel, he's starting to gain that self-confidence. He's starting to figure out that he is worthy of stepping into these shoes and that maybe he can do this. And so we're watching a really interesting dynamic kind of start to form, but still have some restraint on. We get to know a little bit more about Lionel, and we find out that he really started his like speech business when there was no formal training to do any of that. He started spending a lot of his time with Australian soldiers from, they refer to it as the Great War, which is World War One, First World War, all of that. And he was like, you know, they were shell-shocked. That's how he was able to help. He was able to bring them out of that shell-shocked state and work with them. And that was also, we learned from personal experience on Lionel's end. At this point, Birdie's still kind of like, I don't know, you know, he's not fully on board with anything one way or the other. And then Lionel makes a really bold move. He sits in, so obviously, again, the royal family has a lot of things, A, that don't belong to them, but B, that have a lot of historic sentiment. And one of those things is St. Edward's chair. It's also known as King Edward's chair, you know, whatever, sainthood and all that afterwards. And in it is this thing called the Stone of Scone. It's a stone that's used during like the coronation of English monarchs, basically.
It came from Scottish monarchs. It's like hundreds of years old. It's a whole thing. Adopted by English and now later British monarchs, because now it's the British Empire. It's a whole thing, Adam. Whatever. It's a whole thing.
Yeah,
they have like four times as much history.
I know,
as us.
And I'm gonna piss off all of our negative two UK listeners. So or we'll just split it 50-50 down the middle. One's gonna be really pumped, and one's gonna be just pissed. So Lionel, he basically just like dismisses that stone entirely as just like a bobbit. Like he's like, this is nothing. Like, I don't know. That pushes Birdie kind of to a breaking point. He starts going off on Lionel, and in going off, he does not stutter. He does not stammer. He so fluently is able to just speak. Birdie has a moment of realizing he was able to just do that without, essentially without his disability flaring up in that moment. And in also doing that, so that's the literal, you know, physical side. And then the emotional side of that is we get to see Birdie kind of realize, like, I can do this. Like, I can step up into these shoes. I am just as capable of doing this as my predecessors, and I am going to. And so finally, Birdie is able to start rehearsing with Lionel to, like, get through the coronation ceremony and everything. And so, again, as I said, now we're kind of at our big, you know, dramatic, like, because again, that was one piece, right? Like, he's been in the public eye for so long. So, you know, he had one good moment of, you know, proclamation, but like, he still doesn't necessarily have the enthusiastic support and trust, I would say, like, of the people. Birdie realizes that he's going to have to give this declaration of war. He calls Lionel, like, to Buckingham Palace, and he's like, you have to help me get ready to give this radio speech to the entire country. So we get kind of this cool, I don't know, moment. They go to this really tiny studio, which was fun, and I love a period piece studio. Like, it's at the palace. To support them, there is also Winston Churchill is there, and then the prime minister at the time, Neville Chamberlain. So this also gives you a little bit of time period before Winston Churchill was prime minister. In that studio, Winston Churchill tells Birdie that he also had a speech impediment. He was like, but I just, like, you know, use it to my advantage now. Like, I don't let it hinder me. It is a part of me. But once I was able to, like, accept that it was a part of me, then here I am, you know, let's do this. So what winds up happening, which is so cool, is Birdie starts to give his speech the way he's delivering it as if he is saying it to Lionel, because that's his comfort place. And that's where he's been able to find that he can speak, you know, the most freely. And Lionel's there, and he's, you know, helping coach him and everything. Finally, we get a moment of Birdie, like, steps out onto the balcony of the palace and everything. He's able to give this speech in front of thousands of people who have gathered there. I mean, he's in a microphone over loudspeakers. They are cheering and applauding him by the end of it, which is so freaking cool and just, like, awesome. At the end, though, Lionel tells Birdie, like, hey, you're actually still struggling with enunciating, like, you know, and Birdie says, his quote is, I had to throw in a few so they'd know it was me, which is, like, that's just so not something we would have seen him say at the beginning of the film. Like, there was so much self-consciousness, like, around the way he spoke, that for them at the end of the movie to be able to make a joke like that and be like, well, I just, you know, I speak so clearly in public now that, you know, I had to throw in, you know, a few of my impediments so that they knew I'm still, you know, the same prince that is now king. And it was, and again, I think that's an homage to Winston Churchill's, like, taking my disability and using it to my advantage even. Yeah. So super cool. And then we get, which I don't know why we've been ending movies with title cards apparently recently, but we get a title card, and it tells us that Lionel was made the commander of the Royal Victorian Order for services to the crown. And he was always at all of King George VI's speeches during the war, and that they remained really good friends until the king ultimately died from lung cancer in 1952. That's the general plot of the movie. So you can see how 2 hours of that might be a little crazy. Like, that's not, yeah, you know, again, I wanted to pick, and Chandler did a very, very good job of this as well. And like I said, I'm really excited to talk about Chandler's movie. I think a lot of movies surrounding disabilities are often written and created by people who they themselves do not have disabilities. And therefore, there is a lot of undertone of pity. And I think that Chandler and I both wanted to pick movies where we are not pitying anybody who is differently abled, because at the end of the day, like, everybody is, you know, everyone has their own ability. And there are just many, many, many people who are differently abled than other people. And I think that that's what we wanted to highlight, of, like, a speech impediment does make you differently abled. And that's not anything to, like, I don't know, shove under a rug. And I even know, like, you know, there is a lot of discourse about with things like stutters and stammers. And again, I want to be respectful of opinions and things of like, well, why should that be something that somebody has to go to speech therapy for? Like, why are we trying to, you know, quote unquote, correct disability or that behavior or what, well, you know, whatever that thing might be. And that is not my place. And that's not my conversation to be a part of. I am so here to listen about all of that all the time. But I think that this very much was a case of like this individual wanted to find a way to live with his disability. I think it's very easy to look at this movie and be like, oh, if it's about stuttering and going to, you know, speech therapy, it's about overcoming or like fixing the disability. And I actually don't feel that way about this movie. I feel like it's very much about learning to happily live with your disability. Like, again, he's always going to have some sort of stutter or, you know, stammer in his words. And I think that we saw somebody who could not love themselves with their disability. And ultimately, by the end of the movie, was able to be okay and happy and have that confidence with themselves with their disability, but learning to live with it. And in this particular case, learning to live with it, they were also able to, you know, take that and again, like the reference with Winston Churchill, use it to their advantage. And I think that that is why I liked this movie for this theme.
Yeah, I remember seeing this movie in theaters, I think, when it first came out or something. And like, it's a weird memory of mine that's like now fading kind of thing. So I think, I want to say I saw it with like my grandpa or something who's no longer with us. I remember like at like a dinner or something afterwards, we were discussing it. And it was one of those movies that was like pivotal to me as like a 13-year-old, I think I was at the time or something like that. That it was like interesting style, right? Because it's a Tom Hooper movie, right? He has a very interesting style with this where like he frames shots very differently that like aren't like by the, you know, book standard of like film teaching and film school and stuff like that, where he's like putting characters at the edge of the frame or something like that. People aren't fully in frame, but it's all in helping create certain senses of like uncomfortableness or just distance or, you know, closed offness between the characters and stuff like that. And I just found that so thought provoking in that way. And it was good to revisit because I was like, oh yeah, you can definitely still make movies like this, because if you know how you're creating those moments and how you want to persuade to the audience to create those sensations, it's completely possible. So yeah, I did enjoy revisiting it for those reasons. Not the politics of British monarchy stuff and drama.
Amazing. Chandler, I'm very excited to talk about your movie. So let's dive in.
All right. So I chose the 2019 film, The Peanut Butter Falcon, directed and written by Tyler Nielsen and Michael Schwartz. The movie stars Shia LaBeouf and Dakota Johnson, as well as new and upcoming actor Zach Gottsagen, who is a person with Down syndrome. And it was really cool because this movie kind of just got made because Tyler Nielsen and Michael Schwartz met Zach. It was a school for people who wanted to become actors who had disabilities.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, they loved the personality that Zach had, and they were inspired to make a movie with him. And it took like 8 years to like they shot a $20,000 proof of concept with him or something like that. And it just took a while to just get it into development later to actually film it, and getting stars like Shia LaBeouf and Dakota Johnson to be in this movie. And it works really well because Zach plays a character called Zach, who is aspiring to become a wrestler. And so it parallels with kind of like his own like real life desire to become an actor. And so it's just a very touching story in that way. Yeah, I'll just jump into it. I think I'm going to go quickly through the plot a little bit as well, because it's like there's not like a lot to it, but it's just like a fun adventure.
It's an adventure buddy movie. Is really, yeah.
It's kind of like a loose retelling, a modern loose retelling of Huckleberry Finn, more or less.
Yes, that's a great description.
So in this movie, Zach is a young man with Down syndrome who's stuck at a state-run facility for elderly people, even though he is a 22-year-old man with Down syndrome. And that's just where the state put him because his family couldn't. What we know through conversations and dialogue is his family couldn't support him anymore of his quote-unquote needs. So the state put him here. But he hates it there. He's been stuck there for like 2.5 years or something like that. And so he's always been looking to escape. And he is so funny. He is so funny.
He's so funny.
He hatches a plan to like give an older woman pudding to then fake some sort of like incident so then he can try to escape, but then he ends up getting captured and then he gets written up as a flight risk and it causes pain. And this is where we meet Dakota Johnson's character Eleanor, who's kind of like been his caregiver, but she's kind of from like out of town where she's gotten like a degree in this field and stuff like that, and then has come to this area to help out in the state-run facilities. And it's clear that she very much empathizes with Zach and she wants to help him, but she doesn't know how, because we kind of see a bit, and it's not like really like picked at a lot, but we just see the problematic nature at times of government mandated health systems, how they don't help every case to the fullest potential of help that's necessary.
That is a very eloquent way to put it, Chandler. Yes.
But then, like, we kind of get this dichotomy from Zach, and we meet our other character, Tyler, who's played by Shia LaBeouf. We meet him as he's illegally catching crabs, as like a crab fisher, and he's picking up other people's crab catching spots and stealing their catches of the day and stuff like that. As we learn throughout the movie, he's dealing with his own trauma or baggage from the loss of his brother, and those that used to be his brother's spots for crab catching and everything like that.
And part of the conflict is that we learn that there's only like a certain amount of fishing licenses that are allowed within that small town. And when his brother died, he did not get that license. Like it went back into the system and somebody else got it.
And so we learned that about Tyler, and we kind of hop back to Zach, and he gets help from his roommate, who's an elderly man, because he also wants to help Zach get out as well, but he's also tired of watching the same VHS tape of local town wrestler called the Saltwater Redneck. It's like you're like local, like, here, I can train you for this X amount of money nonsense, but it's like all fake. And it's just ads, but it's like, it's funny because it's like that's wrestling world as well anyways, because just it's fun,
absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. Yes.
And so the old man helps Zach escape because there are bars that were pried up against the window and they end up bending the bars open. But then he's like, here's soap. So lather yourself in it so you can slip in. But like also like Zach's like in his underwear only. He's just in his briefs and he escapes and he's just running in his briefs in the middle of the night. And then we watch as Zach arrives to a dock. By coincidence, this is also the dock where Tyler works. And Tyler had recently just got fired from his boss because he was illegally picking up other people's stuff, and that could jeopardize his boss and his business because of the issue with licenses that Adam mentioned before. And so now Tyler's out of a job, but he's like full of all out of just like resentment and anger that's from the baggage of the loss of his brother, but also just he just doesn't know how to deal right now and process everything. So Tyler runs into, I'm just going to call them rivals for right now. It's the best. They're kind of like rivals. Yeah. Rat Boy and Duncan. Duncan and Rat Boy, who are like his rivals.
Which, like, Duncan and Rat Boy, like, what the hell?
They get into an altercation and like Tyler gets messed up, and like, knowing this is Shia LaBeouf, I could see him like asking to be messed up for like the authenticity, because we see him like dirtied up from the ground and everything. And you're like, this is nasty. But like, it's so real. And like, I kind of enjoyed the just of the movie where it was like dirty. It was grungy and it was just like authentic in that way, where it's just like, I don't want to be near all of that mess sometimes because it's just like gross. But it added a lot of realism to it. So Tyler then retaliates by burning all their gear and then running off and being chased off But simultaneously, Zach snuck onto his boat and is hiding out under there and like trying to take a nap after like running all night long. And so then we see a boat chase of Tyler being chased by Duncan and Rat Boy. And then he's trying to hide out. And then he hears Zach vomiting from being seasick.
Yo, just absolutely yak.
Tyler freaks out, uncovers it, and like holds his mouth, and he's like, shut up, pulls a knife on him even, and he's just like, who the hell are you?
Yeah, Hells holds it to his throat immediately.
He's like, who the hell are you? And Zach just responds, Zach, and he just holds him there. He's like, be quiet, you better be quiet, we need to be quiet right now. And then Duncan and Rat Boy disappear, and then he drives his boat back off, and now like Tyler's kind of like on the run now because he burned a bunch of supplies, and it's like huge amount of money of supplies that he burned.
It's like 12, we've learned it's $12,000 worth of gear. Yeah.
And so they kind of like drive out, and then he decides he's got to ditch the boat because I think it also like ran out of gas or something. I don't quite remember. And so they ditch it on like a sandbar that's like the tide hasn't come in yet, so they can like walk off of it. And he shoots holes into his boat so it can just sink there. They can't pick up a trail of him. And then he starts walking off, and then like Zach's kind of just stuck there. And he's like, you better come. The tide's coming in. We get this like really like rough, rocky relationship between the two of them very early on, because like Zach is just lost at this point. He doesn't know where he is, but he knows he wants to get to Aiden, North Carolina, to go meet Saltwater Redneck and learn wrestling from him.
He also can't swim. We learn he can't swim.
Yeah. So he yells at Tyler. Zach yells at Tyler being like, excuse me, sir, I can't swim. And Tyler's like, follow me. And once we get to land, we're going our separate ways.
Yeah. He says, I'm leaving you as soon as I can, is to Zach's face.
And so he kind of wants to get to kind of like shore and like more like civilization, more or less. Tyler takes off, and then he tries to hitchhike his way. He gets picked up by a guy driving a truck with a dog, and he learns from the driver that there was a fire at the docks, which is the one he set, became way big and like did a lot of damage. And so Tyler's like, oh, and then he learns there's roadblocks looking for him because the state police want him now, as well as like he knows Duncan and Rat Boy are after him. So he's like, I forgot something. So he quickly makes his exit to try and not get caught. And then he kind of goes back to where he left Zach. And Zach was at a place where there was a bunch of kids kind of hanging out. When Tyler gets back to where Zach was, we see Zach at the top of this tower that's like into the river. Cause I think it's the river or maybe part of the ocean. I don't know. I think it's the ocean. I don't know. It's weird coastline river delta stuff. We see Zach getting bullied by a kid to jump off, even though Zach can't swim. And so Tyler races and he's like, yo, no, stop, knock it off, knock it off. And then Zach gets pushed off into the water as Tyler races up there, decks the kid, which is like, yeah, what?
Full on decks him. That honestly, that made me laugh. That made me laugh. I was like, yo.
My jaw just dropped. I was like, did I just, what?
Fuck them kids, bro.
Yeah, he's a fucking bully. He's a prick. Yeah, that's fair. I mean, I'm not against it. Yeah, out here yelling
slurs at Zach. And literally went, yeah, fully saying, I don't care that he doesn't know how to swim, jump. And I was like, eek.
No, it's well deserved. So yeah, so Tyler saves Zach from the water, and then he lets him tag along with him, and then they're kind of off venturing. Then we kind of cut back to the care facility with Eleanor, and she sees that Zach's escaped, and then she's trying to figure it out, but then her boss is giving her a lot of heat, even though she's like, we should report this to the state. But her boss is like, no, that's not how we run things here. And we like see the problematic nature of some of these facilities at times based on like whatever motivations are behind it, and it's just issues that arise because who knows what situation that specific care facilities in its relationship to the state, as well as how the state treats people and stuff like that. So then she's like, I will go find him myself because I know where he's going, which he knows is in the wrestling video. And so Eleanor is now on the road trying to find Zach, and she's kind of going around and asking people if they've seen him or not, and like gets close. And then we kind of cut back to Tyler and Zach, and Tyler's like, we need supplies. You don't got any. And he goes and gets supplies. And he goes into a gas station, which is a very funny scene because like Tyler the whole time is carrying this shotgun. Walks into the gas station, gets a bunch of things. The shop owner is like, this will cost you this much. He's like, oh, I don't have that much. Like, and like, Tyler can only afford like fish hooks and a jar of peanut butter in the end. And the store owner's like, I'm not used to negotiating with people with a shotgun. And Tyler's like, oh, my bad. Puts all his things down on the ground and is like super chill. And the guy's like, okay, no problem. And he's like, Tyler's like, do you got any booze or anything of some sort or something? I think he asked for like whiskey or something.
Yeah, any of those $2, yeah, like shooters in the back.
And he's like, no, but I got something I brewed up myself. And it's like his own like brewed up moonshine kind of thing. And he's like, oh, I can't afford it. He's like, no, it's on the house. Just let me take a swig of it to calm my nerves. And then in walks Eleanor. And then we get this like half flirty, but half weird, because it's like this, like, it's like this, to quote Billy Joel, it's this uptown girl with this small town boy vibe going on, you know?
Yes.
And it's like half flirty, but half like ridiculous. And like Eleanor's too good for this guy at the same time kind of stuff. And that's where Tyler learns Zach is on the run and is being looked for. And so when he goes and meets back up with Zach, he's like, I just found your girlfriend. I heard she's looking for you. Now we got something that bonds us together like brothers.
We're both on the run. Yeah.
And so that's kind of like we're like more of their like kind of like friendship kind of, or not even friendship. Like for now, it's like the relationship kind of like has some sort of rope tying them together now to being on the run together. And then he's like, I have two rules. One, don't slow me down. Two, you listen to me no matter what. And then like Zach's like, okay, sure. Yeah. And like Zach ends up getting clothes and shoes at this point as well throughout, because it's ridiculous to be walking barefoot for miles with no clothes on either. And then like Tyler's like, okay, so what are the rules? What's rule number one? And Zach's like, party. He's like, that is not what rule number one is. there's a lot of like funny comedy with that and stuff like that. And it's just so good in this movie. And so they kind of just go off adventuring. And then that's kind of how this movie goes. We just kind of like follow them as they keep venturing on and like a relationship forms. So I'll hit kind of like some of like the big things. They also make a handshake. I forget. They make a handshake that like they only do when like cool shit happens. That's the rule. Only when cool shit happens can they do the handshake. One such of these cool things that happen is them having to cross a giant river because they don't have enough time to walk around, and it will take them back to the main road and they could be caught. So they have to swim across it. So Zach is like using like aired up pants and other like air hole filled bags and stuff to float as Tyler swims across. As they're swimming across, a shrimp fishing boat comes by, and it's a giant shrimp boat.
Huge. Oh my God.
And like,
yeah.
That stress, super stressful for me. They did a good job of like ratcheting the stress for that moment.
They really did. I was panicked. Daria was watching it with me and she was like, oh my God, oh my God. Her hands were like on her face.
They made it. It was like stressful. Like Tyler like used every inch of his willpower to get Zach across, which is really, really amazing. And then he's just exhausted after he gets Zach across, and Zach's like, that was awesome. And then like lifts him up with like no effort whatsoever.
No effort. Yeah. And then just keeps going. He's like, come on.
And so that night they kind of like bond a bit more by talking to each other. And we learn there's like a softer side to Tyler through all of his like kind of chaotic energy. He doesn't care that Zach is a person with Down syndrome. Like, he's capable to do whatever he feels like he can put his mind to. He's like, yeah, sure, you can't be like an Olympic swimmer or like an Olympic baseball player or anything, but like if you want to be a wrestler, you can be a wrestler. Sounds like all these people in your life that put you in one box just don't know anything. They're horrible teachers and coaches, don't know how to help you find who you are. And that was just a really touching moment. And that becomes kind of like a through line with their kind of like friendship and their like brotherly bond, it feels like, in this movie. So as they keep traveling, they end up at some guy's place who's got a bunch of junkyard stuff, and they find a boat there. This is where we meet one of my favorite characters in this movie, the blind man Jasper, who is a blind black man who's also very religious. Like, I think he's like a self-appointed pastor to himself or something because he does baptisms
he does baptisms.
He loves talking about the Lord and Jesus, so like, you know, good on him. And it's just a funny interaction because like they're inspecting the boat, he comes out with a pistol, this blind man comes out with a pistol swinging it around. And he's like, who's out there? Y'all white or black? And they don't answer. And he's like, oh, playing this game. He shoots them. And it's like a foot from Tyler's head. And they both quickly answer, white, white. And he's like, ah, you guys God-fearing? And they're like, yeah. And it's like, ah, why didn't you say so? Come on. And then he's like the most generous man ever. Because he's like, I'll help you because the Lord says I need to help you on your journey. But you can't take that boat. You can take anything else in my junkyard and build y'all a raft and we'll let you sail down, which is just amazing. And then he performs a baptism on Zach. And Zach's very confused because he's like, what's a baptism? And then Tyler's like, it's kind of like swimming. Like that's all he gives them. And then we kind of get a montage of them building their raft. And it's like a Huckleberry Finn raft. And they go floating down the river out to the coast and they start floating down the coast to try and get Zach to Aiden, North Carolina. And throughout all this, Eleanor is still looking for Zach and hopping down and trying and like going down like the theoretical path where she might find him, which is kind of not too far from where they are throughout the movie. Like she's like very close the entire time because we see herself meet Jasper as well.
Same question. Are you God-fearing? Come inside.
Talk about Jesus. And so later that night when they kind of take the raft to shore, that's when they get drunk from the moonshine from the convenience store man. Oh, Tyler helps Zach find his wrestler name. And so Zach's like, I want to be Falcon. And then Tyler's like, hold on. And then Tyler like, it's not even paper mache because he's using nature. He just like,
literal trees and things
through all the things he can find these like wings for Zach, and then uses like ash and stuff to like make war paint and everything. And then Zach's like, I want peanut butter, and then he smears peanut butter all over his face and everything with the war paint, and he's like, I'm the peanut butter Falcon. And then we kind of have this like weird like very primitive kind of night of just fun energy and stuff like that, and like these kind of like in this montage.
Yes.
And then we get to the next morning, Eleanor finds them and like wakes up Zach, and she's like confused. And then Tyler,
who is drunk, passed out, starfished on his back on the beach, like, and she probably thinks he's dead. Yeah. Like that's
she's wondering what the hell is going on. Sees that Tyler's there. Tyler's like, hey, he's fine. He's like, and he explains that like he's made a commitment to Zach and nothing's going to get in the way of this commitment because like he's kind of formed a good bond. Like they have formed a brotherly bond, and something that like Tyler's been missing since he lost his brother. Because we've kind of also found out through some of these nights, through like the dreams that Tyler's been having. And it's beautifully edited in how he remembers like the last like few memories he has of his brother, of like it was clear they got into an accident and it was his fault. And so he's kind of dealing with the guilt of losing his brother by his own hands. So yeah, so Tyler has this commitment to Zach to get him to see the saltwater redneck. So Eleanor drags him away to have a conversation about this is not okay. He needs to go to a facility where like he can be properly taken care of and stuff like that. Meanwhile, Zach picks up the keys that she left next to him and throws them into the ocean. So now she's stuck with them. And so then they
and gets her attention too. He's like, hey, and then make sure she watches him chuck them, which was so good.
And she's just sitting there in shock. And so she's forced to join them now. And so they go on the raft again and they go travel down the coast further. And then we get another hilarious scene because like throughout this, Eleanor's kind of been like super caregiver, but like super mother overbearing kind of. And Tyler's kind of like done with it. And then he's like, all right, we could still train even though we're on the raft. All right, Zach, we're going to do some breathing exercises. Now go dunk your head underwater and see how long you can hold your breath. And then they have a serious conversation while he's like, can't hear them talk. And Tyler's like full on defending Zach of like, stop treating him like he can't take care of himself. Like he can't have his own agency. Like he can do anything he can put his mind to.
I think that's a really good conversation in general. There's a lot of, especially surrounding people with autism and Down syndrome, the idea of being infantilized, being treated, Tyler makes a point of being like, he's 22, like he can put his own shirt on. Cause when Eleanor finds him, she's like, I got it. Like helping him put his shirt on. And Tyler's like, he's 22. He can put his own shirt on. You know, I think that is a huge problem that exists, is just because somebody is differently abled than you does not mean that you all of a sudden get to treat them like a child. They're not children. I mean, unless they are a child, but you know what I mean? Like adults who are differently abled are fully still capable, you know, unless certain circumstances, but
yeah. So it was like good on this conversation within that. And like Zach pops up and it's just like, how long is that? And Tyler's like, real long. And then Eleanor is like, not long enough. And then he dunks his head back under to do it again, because Eleanor has to like argue back with Tyler. And she talks about how she's just worried about him. And like, he's never been out in the real world by himself yet and stuff like that. So like, we understand the concern from Eleanor and the care that she has, but it's also like not best aligned to help Zach at fullest potential. At the same time, we get a point where like, hey, there might be some mutual like benefit here by working together to help Zach. And then we just kind of get these like fun escapades with them where, oh, because after the second time Zach dunks his head, he catches a giant ass fish with his mouth or something.
Yes.
And that's their like lunch/dinner for the day.
And they eat it with peanut butter.
And then we kind of just get like some fun escapades with them before they kind of dock their raft again on a beachside and find like an abandoned kind of like shack that they kind of spend the night in. But that night, Duncan and Rat Boy find them. They torch their raft, which awakens Tyler. And Tyler then gets kind of like, Tyler gets a bit beaten, but then Duncan wants to take something from Tyler. And so he's like, you're going to lose one of your hands. Pick now or I'll choose for you. And Rat Boy's getting ready to shoot one of his hands. But luckily, Zach pops out and threatens them with the shotgun and scares them off because it's a buckshot shotgun. And he's like, I know how to shoot this, because we had earlier in the movie, through some of the bonding and training that Tyler was doing with Zach, taught him how to shoot the shotgun and everything, which was funny because one of the times he flew like 10 feet backwards because he didn't have a good enough stance.
That scene was so good. That little clip. Oh my God.
So then Duncan and Rat Boy kind of get scared off. But then Eleanor has this like other sense of concern of like, what kind of trouble is Tyler in? Is he a good role model for Zach? Should he be around Zach? As soon as the day starts, they make their way down to Aiden, North Carolina. They get to a diner. Eleanor calls her boss, and her boss tells her that he's going to send Zach to a different facility that's going to be horrible for him, because it's like it sounds like it's kind of like its own kind of like juvenile center is what it seems like. And Eleanor's like, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. But like, she can't do anything about it. And so there's a lot of fear for Zach from her about dealing with that. They make their way to the address from the video where Saltwater Redneck should be, but they don't meet him. They meet Clint, who is the man behind the mask of Saltwater Redneck. And he's kind of this washed up wrestler because he clearly made that video back in the 80s or something, 90s maybe even. Who knows? Tyler does the nice thing where he has a quick conversation with Clint, being like, yo, there's this kid here. He wanted to meet the Saltwater Redneck. It's like a superhero to him. He was hoping to learn wrestling from him, but like, I don't want you to ruin that dream of his, because it's the only thing that's like made him try to forge his own way in life. And just to have that respect for Zach, which is like really like good. It was a really good like protection moment by Tyler. And so like Clint introduces himself and he's like apologizes that Saltwater Redneck's not here and everything like that. But Zach is still like very much like, he's got to be around here somewhere kind of thing. And he doesn't want to believe that he's no longer around. And as they're leaving out of nowhere in this like 80s car that's like real dirtied up, but like still a hot rod at the same time.
Whipping around, doing donuts.
And inside driving it is the saltwater redneck. And then like Zach is like thrilled and everything. And then we kind of just hop to Clint teaching Zach some wrestling moves and stuff like that, which is really fun. And a lot of just, it was just good and fun energy with Zach doing crazy stuff. And he's like, I want to know how to do the, I forgot what the move was called.
The atomic throw.
Yeah, the atomic throw. Yeah, where it's like you lift a whole person above your head and throw them out of the ring. And then like Clint's like, oh, that's not real. No one can actually really do that. That was just editing of like me making it seem like held someone up and then just cutting to someone else being thrown out of a ring in professional world. But then like Clint kind of gets rejuvenated of like, oh, I remember my love of wrestling kind of thing. And he's like, Zach, you want to wrestle for real? We've got a match tomorrow. I could put you on the ticket. And like, and it's with the intent to like kind of rig it for Zach. So like Zach could win just to be like a powerful story because, you know, he's not a professional wrestler. He's had a day of training versus some of these people that have been doing it who are now doing it in these like sketchy matches that have been like washed out wrestlers is what it seems like, right? Like that's what it feels like. And so the next day they're taking Zach to the wrestling match and like we see it's kind of like pretty brutal, and it's not like WWE where it's like partially theatrical or anything. It's like full on.
Yeah,
like,
they're getting bloodied and beat.
Eleanor's getting understandably very concerned because she's like, I don't want Zach to possibly die, like is her mindset with this. And so Tyler and her have like a conversation, but then like there's also like a new connection forming between them that's kind of been growing between the two of them that kind of solidifies of like they might be falling in love kind of thing. But Tyler uses that to trick her and handcuffs her in the car so he can help Zach achieve his dream of wrestling in the ring. So then Tyler goes and like talks to Zach, who's getting ready in like the makeshift locker room that's in a barn, I think, or shed or shack or something. And he's like, we gotta get you dressed up. Let me go find some cardboard and duct tape. And then like fully paper mache's this like whole falcon wings and headpiece. And he comes charging out, and Tyler's like the best hype man for Zach and actually gets the crowd going.
It
was
awesome. It went from dead silence and blank stares to just like a cheering crowd. Zach is like dapping everybody up. They're in it. He kisses a woman on the head. I was like, okay, man, do you, dude.
And then we kind of get the wrestling match starting, but then the opponent he's fighting against doesn't want to lose and doesn't. He thinks rigging the game is stupid, and he feels it's like a attack on him and everything. It's like it's a whole ego thing for him. And he starts like really slamming into Zach and throwing him around a bit.
Yeah. And also definitely trying to be antagonistic towards his disability.
Yeah. It's kind of the struggle that's always there for people like Zach of just like believing they're just lesser no matter what because of their disability, which is really shitty. But then like Zach gets this like crazy momentum of just strength and ends up lifting the guy to throw him out of the ring.
Which he's like three times Zach's size, if we're being so for real.
But like while, and like it's a beautiful moment because like we start losing all of like the real world sound, the diegetic sound. And we just get non-diegetic music score filling and having it happen. But while this is happening, some guy in the audience recognized Tyler earlier, called up Duncan, and then Duncan and Ratboy had arrived. And Duncan is charging over to Tyler to whack him in the head with a tire iron. And like just as Zach is throwing his opponent out of the ring and like shocking everyone, throwing him out of the ring. Even Ratboy's like, what? Duncan swings the tire iron and whacks Tyler in the head. And it just cuts to black. The scenes following is also very beautiful because we're just stuck with just music and no real world sound and everything. And we just see the aftermath like in the hospital and just everyone dealing with that fallout of just like Tyler being like, we don't know what's happened to Tyler, honestly. And everyone's just scared for him. And then our final shot, Zach with, I want to say it's like a few cupcakes with candles for his birthday, because it's like his birthday as well. and he blows them out because earlier in the movie, I think it's not too long after they built the raft and started sailing, Zach was like, hey, for my birthday, when I blow out the candles and make a wish, all the wishes are for you. You get to use my wishes. And it was such a really touching moment. And that, like, in that moment, Tyler like had like broken down and was like super thankful of just like that act of kindness for him. And then we cut to black again. And then we open up back up and Eleanor and Zach are in a car driving on the road. And we see a sign to Florida. Welcome to Florida. They're like, we see a sign of excitement on their faces. And Zach reaches to the back and there's Tyler in the back, pretty beaten up still and bandaged and recovering. But we just see them making a new chapter for themselves. And it's clear like they're choosing to be like their own kind of family together in this new chapter of their lives.
Dude, they got me good though. They got me good because I thought Tyler died. I dead ass thought Tyler died.
The first time I saw this movie, I thought that too.
Because the way that they just did everything in the hospital through to until Zach reaches behind him to like touch somebody in the back to let them know that they're in Florida, you are being led to think that something really, really bad happened.
And then that's kind of just how the movie ends. And it's like this, like, it's a really powerful story and it's like a really huge bonding thing. And it's like, I know Shia LaBeouf's got a lot of controversy and everything in general, but like for this movie, I know he cared about the characters and stuff like that. And that, like, the thing he took away, and I've watched a lot of interviews because I was just curious about the production of this movie and everything. The one thing he took away from this movie is his friendship with Zach. And he's super thankful for it because like they text each other and stuff like that. And he's like, showed that there's a side of me where I can just like be open and not like have to be stuck in like Hollywood actor brain and just like really just like make me softer. And I was like really touching of just like, that's awesome.
That's really cool. I loved this movie. I would totally watch this movie again. It was really good.
It was true to life of like how some people do negatively treat people with these kinds of disabilities and stuff like that. But then also was empowering enough because Zach is a character in it of himself, right? And he's funny. He's hilarious. He's very motivated and driven. And it was powerful story in that sense of like Zach has a lot of his own agency. It's just the world around him won't let him have that agency. And that was a very good theme through this movie.
100%. Yes. Well, Chandler, next week, we are continuing our Breaking Bad saga. For those of you who don't know, this is our 16th episode of us talking about Breaking Bad, fun fact. And we will be covering episodes 5 through 8, so another 4-episode chunk here, which I believe finishes season 5A.
Yeah, so it's going to be exciting.
I mean, the shit is all hitting the fan, so I'm buckled in, right? You know, my lap bar is secure. It's locked. I'm I'm ready for the ride.
Yeah, let's see what chaos is going to come from this whole situation that we're in with Breaking Bad. But yeah, in the meantime, please like, follow, subscribe on all the platforms. Give us ideas in the comments about movies for us to watch or themes of movies for us to find. We're open to everything. Also, other disability awareness movies that you find really empowering and amazing.
Yes, definitely that. Also, I have a movie shout out, which honestly, I meant to shout out on our last episode and I forgot because it just happened to be that I watched it and it matched that theme. But I just recently watched the movie Civil War that came out this year. It's an A24 film. And as I have stated in last week's episode as well, I am a sucker for anything A24 or Monkey Paw. Dude, it's so good. It's very, very good. I highly recommend it. I did have to buy it. I couldn't find it to stream anywhere, so that was unfortunate. But it is a really good movie. And if you watch it, we should talk about it. Okay.
Maybe we'll save that for like near the end of the year or something, of just like powerful movies of the year.
I'm here for it.
Anyways, you've been listening to Resonant Reels. I've been Chandler.
I've been Adam.
We'll see you next time.
Cheers.